making, the officials insisted that one of the visiting chiefs must accept responsibility for all seven bands represented. Ore the Arrow was the unanimous choice for chief of all the Utes. He was half Apache, half Uncompahgre Ute, a handsome, round-faced, sharp-eyed Indian who could speak English and Spanish as fluently as the two Indian tongues he knew. When the land-hungry politicians tried to put him on the defensive, Ore was sophisticated enough to present the Ute's case to newspaper reporters. "The agreement an Indian makes to a United States treaty," he said, "is like the agreement a buffalo makes with his hunters when pierced with arrows. All he can do is lie down and give in." The officials could not fool Ore with their bright-tinted maps and unctuous phraseology about boundary lines. Instead of accepting a small corner of western Colorado, he held out for 16 million acres of western slope forests and meadows. Considerably less territory than his people had claimed before, but considerably more than the Colorado politicians wanted them to have. Two agencies were to be established, one at Los Pinos for the Uncompahgres and other southern bands, one on White River for the northern bands. Ore also demanded the inclusion of certain protective clauses in the new treaty, words meant to keep miners and settlers off the Ute reservation. According to the treaty, no unauthorized white men would ever be permitted to pass over, settle upon, or reside in the territory assigned to the Utes. In spite of this restriction, the miners continued to trespass. Among them was Frederick W. Pitkin, a New England Yankee who ventured into the San Juan Mountains and made a quick fortune mining silver. In 1872, Pitkin became a leading advocate among owners of wealthy mining interests who wanted to add the San Juan area, one-fourth of the Ute Reservation, to Colorado Territory. Bowing to the miners' wishes, the Indian Bureau sent out a special commission headed by Felix R. Bruneau to negotiate with the Utes for cession of this land. At Los Pinos Agency in September 1873, Bruneau's commission met Ore and representatives of the seven Ute nations. Bruneau told the chiefs that the Great Father had asked him to come and talk to them about giving up some of their reservation land. He assured them that he did not want the land for himself, and had not come to tell them what to do, but to hear what they had to say about the matter. "It is much better sometimes to do what does not please us just now," Bruneau counseled, "if we think it will be best for our children." The chiefs wanted to know how it would benefit their children if they gave up their land. Bruneau explained that the government would set aside a large sum of money for the Utes, and each year the tribe would be paid interest from it for the ceded land. "I do not like the interest part of the agreement," Ore declared. "I would rather have the money in the bank." He then complained because the government had not kept its treaty promise to remove white men who were found trespassing on the Ute reservation. Bruneau replied frankly that if the government tried to drive the miners out, this would bring on a war, and the Utes would lose their land without receiving any pay for it. "The best thing that can be done," he said, "if you can spare these mountains, is to sell them and to have something coming in every year." "The miners care very little about the government and do not obey the laws," Ore agreed. "They say they do not care about the government. It is a long way off in the States, and they say the man who comes to make the treaty will go off to the States and it will all be as they want it." "Suppose you sell the mountains," Bruneau continued, "and if there is no gold in them, then it would be a benefit to you. The Utes get the pay for them, and the Americans would stay away. But suppose there are mines there, it will not stop the trouble. We could not keep the people away." "Why cannot you stop them?" Ore demanded. "Is not the government strong enough to keep its agreements with us?" "I would like to stop them," Bruneau said, "but Ore knows it is hard to do." Ore said he was willing to sell the mountains, but not all the fine hunting land around them. "The whites can go and take the gold and come out again. We do not want them to build houses there." Bruneau replied that he did not believe this could be done. There was no way to force the miners to leave Ute territory once they had come and dug their mines there. "I will ask the Great Father to drive the miners away," he promised, "but 1,000 other men will tell him to let them alone. Perhaps he will do as I say, perhaps not." After 7 days of discussions, the chiefs agreed to accept the government's offer of $25,000 a year for the 4 million acres of treasure. As a bonus, Ore was to receive a salary of $1,000 a year for 10 years, or so long as he shall remain head chief of the Utes and at peace with the United States. Thus did Ouray become a part of the establishment, motivated to preserve the status quo. Living in a paradise of magnificent meadows and forests abundant with wild game, berries, and nuts, the Utes were self-supporting and could have existed entirely without the provisions doled out to them by their agents at Los Pinos and White River. In 1875, Agent F.F. Bond at Los Pinos replied to a request for a census of his Utes. "A count is quite impossible. You might as well try to count a swarm of bees when on the wing. They travel all over the country like the deer which they hunt." Agent E.H. Danforth at White River estimated that about 900 Utes used his agency as a headquarters, but he admitted that he had had no luck in inducing them to settle down in the valley around the agency. At both places, the Utes humored their agents by keeping small beef herds and planting a few rows of corn, potatoes, and turnips, but there was no real need for any of these pursuits. The beginning of the end of freedom upon their own reservation came in the spring of 1878, when a new agent reported for duty at White River. The agent's name was Nathan C. Meeker, former poet, novelist, newspaper correspondent, and organizer of cooperative agrarian colonies. Most of Meeker's ventures failed, and although he sought the agency position because he needed the money, he was possessed of a missionary fervor and sincerely believed that it was his duty as a member of a superior race to elevate and enlighten the Utes. As he phrased it, he was determined to bring them out of savagery through the pastoral stage to the barbaric, and finally to the enlightened scientific and religious stage. Meeker was confident he could accomplish all this in 5, 10, or 20 years. In his humorless and overbearing way, Meeker set out systematically to destroy everything the Utes cherished, to make them over into his own image, as he believed he had been made in God's image. His first unpopular action was to move the agency 15 miles down White River, where there was fine pasture land suitable for plowing. Here Meeker planned to build a cooperative agrarian colony for Ute Indians, but he overlooked the fact that the Utes had long been using the area as a hunting ground and for pasturing their horses. The site he chose to build agency buildings on was a traditional racing strip where the Utes enjoyed their favorite sport of betting on pony races. Meeker found Quinkent, Douglas, to be the most amiable of the chiefs at White River. He was a Yampa Ute, about 60 years old, his hair still dark, his pendant mustaches turning white. Douglas owned more than 100 ponies, which made him rich by Ute standards, but he had lost most of his following among the younger men to Nickaagat, Jack. Like Ouray, Jack was a half-blood Apache. As a boy, he had learned to speak a few words of English while living with a Mormon family, and he had served as a scout for General Crook during the Sioux Wars. When he first met Meeker, Jack was wearing his scout uniform, frontier buckskins, army boots, and a wide-brimmed hat. He always wore the silver medal given him by the Great Father when he went to Washington with Ouray in 1868. Jack and his people were away on a buffalo hunt during the period that Meeker moved the agency, and when they came back to the original site, they found everything gone. They made camp there, and after a few days, Meeker came up to order Jack to move to the new site. "I told him," Meeker, "that the site of the old agency had been settled by treaty," Jack said afterward, "and that I knew of no law or treaty that made mention of the new site. Then the agent told me that we had better all move down below, and that if we did not, we should be obliged to. That for that they had soldiers." Meeker tried to placate Jack by promising to obtain milk cows for his band, but Jack replied that Utes had no need for either cows or milk. Collaro was the third chief of importance, a Muach Ute in his 60s. For a few years after the Treaty of 1868, Collaro and his people lived on a small temporary reservation adjoining Denver. When it pleased them, they roamed freely through the town, dining in restaurants, attending theaters, and clowning for the white citizens. In 1875, the reservation was closed, and Collaro took his Muaches up to White River to join Jack's people. They missed the excitement of Denver, but enjoyed the fine hunting in the White River country. The Muaches were not interested in Meeker's agrarian society, and they visited the agency only when they wanted a few sacks of flour or some coffee and sugar. Kanala, Johnson, was the chief medicine man, a brother-in-law of Oray, and the operator of the pony racing track where Meeker wanted to build the new agency houses. Johnson liked to wear a plugged hat, which he had obtained in Denver. For some reason, Meeker chose Johnson as the most likely man to help him lead the Utes out of savagery. Also to assist him in his great crusade, Meeker brought his wife, Arvilla, and his daughter Josie to the agency. He employed 7 white workmen, including a surveyor, to lay out an irrigation canal, a lumberman, a bridge builder, a carpenter, and a mason. These men were expected to teach the Utes their trades while they were building the new agrarian paradise. It was Meeker's fancy to have the Utes address him as Father Meeker. In their savage state, he looked upon them as children, but most of them called him Nick, much to his displeasure. By the spring of 1879, Meeker had a few agency buildings under construction and 40 acres of land plowed. Most of the work was done by his white employees, who were paid money for their efforts. Meeker could not understand why the Utes also expected money for building their very own cooperative agrarian community, but in order to get his irrigation ditches dug, he agreed to pay money to 30 Utes. They were willing workers until Meeker's funds were exhausted. Then they went away to hunt or attend pony races. "Their needs are so few that they do not wish to adopt civilized habits," Meeker complained to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs. "What we call conveniences and comforts are not sufficiently valued by them to cause them to undertake to obtain them by their own efforts. The great majority look upon the white man's ways with indifference and contempt." He proposed a course of action to correct this barbaric condition. First, take away the Utes' hundreds of ponies so that they could not roam and hunt, replace the ponies with a few draft horses for plowing and hauling, and then as soon as the Utes were thus forced to abandon the hunt and remain near the agency, he would issue no more rations to those who would not work. "I shall cut every Indian down to the bare starvation point," he wrote Colorado's Senator Henry M. Teller, "if he will not work." Meeker's inveterate itch for writing down his ideas and observations and then sending them off to be put into print eventually brought him to a complete breaking point with the Utes. During the spring of 1879, he wrote an imaginary dialogue with one of the Ute women, attempting to show how the Indians could not comprehend the joys of work or the value of material goods. During the course of his dialogue, Meeker declared that the reservation land belonged to the government and was only assigned to the Utes for their use. "If you don't use it and won't work," he warned, "white men away off will come in, and by you will have nothing." This little composition was first published in the Greeley, Colorado, Tribune, where it was seen by William B. Vickers, a Denver editor-politician who despised all Indians, especially Utes. Vickers at that time was serving as secretary to Frederick Pitkin, the wealthy miner who in 1873 had been the leader in separating the San Juan Mountains from Ute ownership. Pitkin had used his power to become governor of Colorado when it became a state in 1876. After the end of the Sioux Wars in 1877, Pitkin and Vickers began drumming up a propaganda campaign to have all the Utes exiled to Indian territory, thus leaving an immense amount of valuable land free for the taking. Vickers seized upon Nathan Meeker's newspaper essay as a fine argument for removing the Utes from Colorado, and he wrote an article about it for the Denver Tribune. "The Utes are actual, practical communists, and the government should be ashamed to foster and encourage them in their idleness and wanton waste of property. Living off the bounty of a paternal but idiotic Indian bureau, they actually become too lazy to draw their rations in the regular way but insist on taking what they want wherever they find it. Removed to Indian territory, the Utes could be fed and clothed for about one half what it now costs the government." Honorable N.C. Meeker, the well-known superintendent of the White River Agency, was formerly a fast friend and ardent admirer of the Indians. He went to the agency in the firm belief that he could manage the Indians successfully by kind treatment, patient precept, and good example. But utter failure marked his efforts, and at last he reluctantly accepted the truth of the border truism that the only truly good Indians are dead ones. Vickers wrote considerably more, and his article was reprinted across Colorado under the title "The Utes Must Go." By late summer of 1879, most of the white orators who abounded in frontier Colorado were uttering the applause-producing cry, The Utes must go whenever they were called upon to speak in public places. In various ways, the Utes learned that Nick Meeker had betrayed them in print. They were especially angry because their agent had said the reservation land did not belong to them, and they delivered a sort of official protest to him through the agency interpreter. Meeker reiterated his statement and added that he had the right to plow any of the reservation he chose because it was government land, and he was the agent of the government. Meanwhile, William Vickers was accelerating his Utes Must Go campaign by manufacturing stories of Indian crimes and outrages. He even blamed the numerous forest fires of that unprecedented drought year on the Utes. On July 5th, Vickers prepared a telegram to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs for Governor Pitkin's signature. "Reports reach me daily that a band of White River Utes are off their reservation, destroying forests. They have already burned millions of dollars of timber and are intimidating settlers and miners. I am satisfied there is an organized effort on the part of Indians to destroy the timber of Colorado. These savages should be removed to Indian territory, where they can no longer destroy the finest forests in this state." The commissioner replied with a promise to the governor to take action, and then sent a warning to Meeker to keep his Utes on the reservation. When Meeker sent for the chiefs, he discovered they were holding an indignation meeting. They had already heard about the governor's false charges and his threats to send them to Indian territory. A white friend named Peck, who operated a supply store on Bear River north of the reservation, had read the story in a Denver newspaper and told it to Nickaagat, Jack. According to the news report, the Utes had set fires along Bear River and burned down a house belonging to James B. Thompson, a former Ute agent. Jack was much disturbed by the account, and Peck agreed to go with him to Denver to see Governor Pitkin to tell him that it was not true. They chose a route which would take them by the Thompson house. "We passed by there," Jack said afterward, "and we saw Thompson's house standing. It was not burned." After a great deal of difficulty, Jack secured admittance to Governor Pitkin's office. "The governor asked me how things were in my country, on White River, saying that the papers were saying a great deal about us. I told him I thought so myself, and for that reason I had come to Denver. I said I did not understand why this business was in such a state. He then said, 'Here is a letter from your Indian agent.' I told him that as the Indian agent, Meeker, could write, he had written that letter, but that I, not being able to write, had come to see him in person and answer it. That much we talked, and then I told him I did not wish him to believe what was written in that letter. He asked me if it was true that Thompson's house was burned. I told him that I had seen the house, that it was not burned. I then talked to the governor about the Indian agent and told him it would be well for him to write to Washington and recommend that some other agent be put in his place, and he promised to write the next day." Pitkin, of course, had no intention of recommending a replacement for Meeker. From the governor's viewpoint, everything was moving in the right direction. All he had to do was wait for a showdown between Meeker and the Utes. And then, perhaps, the Utes must go. About this same time, Meeker was preparing his monthly report for the Commissioner of Indian Affairs. He wrote that he was planning to establish a police force among the Utes. "They are in a bad humor," he added. Yet only a few days later he initiated actions which he surely must have known would make the Utes even more belligerent. Although there is no direct evidence that Meeker sympathized with Governor Pitkin's Utes Must Go program, almost every step he took seemed designed to arouse the Indians to revolt. Meeker may not have wanted the Utes to go, but he certainly wanted their ponies banished. Early in September, he ordered one of his white workmen, Shadrach Price, to begin plowing a section of grassland on which the Utes pastured their ponies. Some of the Utes protested immediately, asking Meeker why he did not plow somewhere else. They needed the grass for their ponies. West of the pasture was a section of sage land, which Quinkent, Douglas, offered to clear for plowing, but Meeker stubbornly insisted upon plowing up the grass. The Utes' next move was to send out a few young men with rifles. They approached the plowman and ordered him to stop. Shadrach Price obeyed, but when he reported the threat to Meeker, the agent sent him back to finish his work. This time the Utes fired warning shots above Price's head, and the plowman hurriedly unhitched his horses and left the pasture. Meeker was furious. He composed an indignant letter to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs. "This is a bad lot of Indians," he wrote. "They have had free rations so long and have been flattered and petted so much that they think themselves lords of all." That afternoon, the medicine man, Kanala Johnson, came to the agency office to see Meeker. He told Meeker that the land being plowed had been assigned to him for pasturing his ponies. Now that the plowing was stopped, he did not want it started again. Meeker interrupted Johnson's impassioned speech. "The trouble is this, Johnson. You have too many ponies. You had better kill some of them." For a moment, Johnson stared at Meeker in disbelief. Suddenly, he moved toward the agent, caught him by the shoulders, pushed him out on the porch, and shoved him against the hitching rail. Without saying a word, Johnson then stalked away. Johnson afterward related his version of the incident. "I told the agent that it was not right that he should order the men to plow my land. The agent told me I was always a troublesome man, and that it was likely I might come to the calaboose. I told him that I did not know why I should go to prison. I told the agent that it would be better for another agent to come, who was a good man and was not talking such things. I then took the agent by the shoulder and told him it was better that he should go. Without doing anything else to him, striking him or anything else, I just took him by the shoulder. I was not mad at him. Then I went to my house." Before Meeker took further action, he summoned Nickaagat, Jack, to his office for a talk. Jack later recalled the meeting. "Meeker told me that Johnson had been mistreating him. I told Meeker that it was nothing, that it was a small matter, and he had better let it drop. Meeker said it didn't make any difference, that he would mind it and complain about it. I still told him that it would be a very bad business to make so much fuss about nothing. Meeker said he didn't like to have a young man take hold of him, that he was an old man and had no strength to retaliate, and he didn't want to have a young man take hold of him in that way. He said that he was an old man, and Johnson had mistreated him, and he would not say any more to him. That he was going to ask the commissioner for soldiers, and that he would drive the youths from their lands. Then I told him it would be very bad to do that. Meeker said that anyhow the land did not belong to the youths. I answered that the land did belong to the youths, and that was the reason why the government had the agencies there, because it was the youths' land. And I told him again that the trouble between him and Johnson was a very small matter, and he had better let it drop and not make so much fuss about it." For another day and night, Meeker brooded over his deteriorating relations with the Utes, and then he finally made up his mind that he must teach them a lesson. He dispatched two telegrams, one to Governor Pitkin asking for military protection, another to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs. "I have been assaulted by a leading chief, Johnson, forced out of my own house and injured badly. It is now revealed that Johnson originated all the trouble. His son shot at the plowman, and the opposition to plowing is wide. Plowing stops. Life of self, family, and employees not safe. Want protection immediately. Have asked Governor Pitkin to confer with General Pope." During the following week, the ponderous machineries of the Interior and War Departments slowly moved into action. On September 15th, Meeker received notice that orders were being transmitted to cavalry units to march to White River. The agent was authorized to arrest leaders in the late disturbance. The War Department dispatched orders to Major Thomas T. Thornburg, commanding at Fort Fred Steele, to move with a sufficient number of troops to the White River Ute Agency, Colorado, under special instructions. Because Thornburg was on an elk hunt, the orders were delayed in reaching him, and he did not move out until September 21st. For the 150-mile march to White River, he outfitted about 200 cavalrymen and mounted infantrymen. On September 25th, Thornburg reached Fortification Creek. The column was about halfway to the White River Agency, and the major decided to send one of his guides ahead to notify Meeker that he could reach the agency in four more days. He asked Meeker to inform him of the current situation there. On that same day, Collaro and Nickaagat, Jack, learned of the approaching soldiers. The Ute chiefs were moving with their people toward Milk River for the customary autumn hunts. Jack rode north to Bear River and met the troops there. "What is the matter?" he asked them. "What are you coming for? We do not want to fight with the soldiers. We have the same father over us. We do not want to fight them." Thornburg and his officers told Jack that they had received a telegram to go to the agency, that the Indians were burning up the forests around there and had burned Mr. Thompson's cabin. Jack replied that it was a lie. The Utes had not burned any forests or cabins. "You leave your soldiers here," he said to Thornburg. "I am a good man. I am Nika'agat. Leave your soldiers here, and we will go down to the agency." Thornburg replied that he had orders to march his soldiers to the agency. Unless he received word from Agent Meeker to halt the column, he would have to take the soldiers on to White River. Jack again insisted that the Utes did not want to fight. He said it was not good that soldiers were coming into their reservation. Then he left Thornburg and hurried back to the agency to warn Nick Meeker that bad things would happen if he let the soldiers come to White River. On the way to Meeker's office, Jack stopped to see Quinkent, Douglas. They were rival chiefs, but now that all the White River Utes were in danger, Jack felt that the leaders must not be divided. The young Utes had heard too much talk about the white men sending them off to Indian territory. Some said they had heard Meeker boast that the soldiers were bringing a wagon load of handcuffs and shackles and ropes, and that several bad Utes would be hanged, and others taken as prisoners. If they believed the soldiers were coming to take them away from their homeland, they would fight them to the death, and not even the chiefs could stop them from fighting. Douglas said that he wanted nothing to do with it. After Jack left, he put his American flag on a pole and mounted it above his lodge. Perhaps he had not heard that Black Kettle of the Cheyennes was flying an American flag at Sand Creek in 1864. "I told the agent, Meeker, that the soldiers were coming," Jack said, "and that I hoped he would do something to stop their coming to the agency. He said it was none of his business. He would have nothing to do with it. I then said to the agent I would like he and I to go where the soldiers were to meet them. The agent said that I was all the time molesting him. He would not go. This he told me in his office, and after finally speaking, he got up and went into another room and shut and locked the door. That was the last time I ever saw him." Later in the day, Meeker evidently changed his mind and decided to heed Jack's advice. He sent a message to Major Thornburg, suggesting that he halt his column and then come to the agency with an escort of 5 soldiers. "The Indians seem to consider the advance of the troops as a declaration of real war," he wrote. On the following day, September 28th, when the message reached Thornburg's camp on Deer Creek, Collaro also arrived there to try to convince the major that he should proceed no farther. "I told him I did not know at all why the troops had come," Collaro said afterward, "or why there should be war." The column was then only 35 miles from White River Agency. After reading Meeker's message, Thornburg told Collaro that he would move his troops down to the Milk River boundary of the Ute Reservation. There he would camp his soldiers, and then he and 5 men would go on to the agency to confer with Meeker. Not long after Collaro and his braves left Thornburg's camp, the major held an officers' meeting, during which he decided to change his plans. Instead of halting on the edge of the reservation, the column would march on through Coal Creek Canyon. This was a military necessity, Thornburg explained, because Collaro's and Jack's camps were just below it. If the troops halted on Milk River and the Utes decided to block the canyon, they could keep the soldiers from reaching the agency. From the south end of the canyon, however, only a few miles of open country would lie between them and White River. Riding ahead of the column, Collaro arrived at his camp about 9 o'clock on the morning of the 29th. He found his people very much excited over the approach of the soldiers. "I saw several start out in the direction toward the road where the soldiers were," he said. "Afterward, I left also and came up to where the first ones who went out had gathered." There, he met Jack and about 60 of his warriors. The two chiefs exchanged information, Jack telling Collaro about his unsatisfactory meeting with Meeker, and Collaro telling Jack that Major Thornburg had promised to halt his soldiers at Milk River. "I then told Jack I thought it would be well for him to advise the young men not to make any warlike demonstrations at all, and he said it would be better to move them a piece off from the road. As yet we saw no soldiers from where we were, and we retired some distance from the road." Jack then said that when the soldiers should have arrived at Milk River, the line of the reservation, he would go down and see them. Neither Collaro nor Jack knew that Thornburg's column had already passed Milk River. After watering his horses there, Thornburg decided to send the wagons along the canyon road with 1 escort troop while he took the remainder of the cavalry over a more direct route across a high ridge. By an irony of chance, this would bring them directly upon the angry Utes that Jack had drawn away from the road in order to avoid any possible encounter. About this time, a young Ute who had gone ahead to reconnoiter came galloping back. "The troops are not stopping where they promised to stop yesterday, but are coming on," he told Jack. Very much concerned now, Jack started up the ridge with his small band of warriors. In a few minutes he could see the soldiers' wagons, strung out along the road that twisted through the sagebrush toward the canyon. I stood up on the hill with 20 or 30 of my men, and all at once I saw 30 or 40 soldiers in my front. And just as soon as they saw me, they deployed off one after another. I was with General Crook the year before, fighting the Sioux, and I knew in a minute that as soon as this officer deployed his men out in that way, it meant fight. So I told my men to deploy also. The officer commanding the advance cavalry troop was Lieutenant Samuel Cherry. After ordering his men to deploy, Cherry halted them at the base of the ridge and waited for Major Thornburg to come forward. Thornburg rode out a few yards and waved his hat to the Indians watching from the ridge. Several waved back. For 4 or 5 minutes, Jack waited for one of the officers to signal for a council, but they held their positions as though expecting the Utes to make the first move. Then, Jack said afterward, I and another Indian went out to meet them. Lieutenant Cherry dismounted and started walking toward the Utes. After taking a few steps, he waved his hat. A second later, a single rifle shot broke the silence. While we were still some distance apart between the skirmish lines, Jack said, a shot was fired. I don't know from which side, and in a second so many shots were fired that I knew I could not stop the fight, although I swung my hat to my men and shouted, "Don't fire! We only want to talk!" But they understood me to be encouraging them to fight. While the fighting grew in intensity, spreading to the wagon train, which went into a corral defense, news of the encounter reached Quinkent, Douglas, at the agency. He immediately went to Nick Meeker's office and told him that soldiers had come inside the reservation. Douglas was sure the Ute warriors would fight them. Meeker replied that he did not believe there would be any trouble. And then he asked Douglas to go with him the following morning to meet the soldiers. By early afternoon, all the Utes at White River had heard that the soldiers were fighting their people at Milk River. About a dozen of them took their rifles and went out among the agency buildings, shooting at every white workman in sight. Before the day ended, they killed Nathan Meeker and all his white male employees. They made captives of the 3 white women and then fled toward an old Ute camp on Piance Creek. Along the way, each of the 3 white women was raped. For almost a week, the fighting continued at Milk River, with 300 Ute warriors virtually surrounding the 200 soldiers. Major Thornburg was killed in the first skirmishing. When the fighting ended, his column had lost 12 killed, 43 wounded. 37 Utes died in what they believed was a desperate stand to save their reservation from military seizure and to keep themselves from being taken as prisoners to Indian territory. At the Los Pinos Agency, 150 miles to the south, Chief O'Reilly heard of the fighting with dismay. He knew that only immediate action could save his chieftainship and the entire Ute reservation. He dispatched a message by runner on October 2nd. To the chief captains, headmen, and Utes at the White River Agency, you are hereby requested and commanded to cease hostilities against the whites, injuring no innocent persons or any others farther than to protect your own lives and property from unlawful and unauthorized combinations of horse thieves and desperados, as anything farther will ultimately end in disaster to all parties. O'Reilly's message and the arrival of cavalry reinforcements ended the fighting, but it was already too late to save the Utes from disaster. Governor Pitkin and William Vickers had been flooding Colorado with wild atrocity stories, many of them aimed at the innocent uncompagres at Los Pinos, most of whom were going peacefully about their business with no knowledge of what was happening at White River. Vickers called upon the white citizens of Colorado to rise up and wipe out the Red Devils, inspiring the frantic organization of militia units in towns and villages across the state. So many newspaper reporters arrived from the east to report this exciting new Indian War that Governor Pitkin decided to give them a special statement for publication. I think the conclusion of this affair will end the depredations in Colorado. It will be impossible for the Indians and whites to live in peace hereafter. This attack had no provocation, and the whites now understand that they are liable to be attacked any part of the state where the Indians happen to be in ancient force. My idea is that, unless removed by the government, they must necessarily be exterminated. I could raise 25,000 men to protect the settlers in 24 hours. the state would be willing to settle the Indian trouble at its own expense. The advantages that would accrue from the throwing open of 12 million acres of land to miners and settlers would more than compensate all the expenses incurred. The White River Utes surrendered their 3 women captives, and then the inevitable investigating commission was formed to sift the causes, fix the blame, and set the punishments. The fight at Milk River was called an ambush, which it was not, and the affair at White River Agency was called a massacre, which it was. Jack and Collaro and their followers were eventually excused from punishment on the grounds that they were warriors engaged in a fair fight. Douglas and the men at the agency were judged as murderers, but there was no one who could identify the Utes who had fired the shots that killed Nathan Meeker and his employees. Douglas testified that he was in the agency storeroom when he heard the first gunshot. "I left the storeroom and went out a little way. Then I went to my house directly from where I was. When I started and got to my house, it made me cry to think into what a state my friends had fallen." But because Arvilla Meeker swore in secret hearings that Douglas had forced sexual union with her, the 60-year-old chief was sent off to Leavenworth Prison. He was not charged with or tried for any crime. A public accusation of rape would have caused embarrassment to Mrs. Meeker, and in that age of sexual reticence, the fact that the act involved an Indian made it doubly abhorrent. Individual punishments, however, were of little interest to the miners and politicians. They wanted to punish the entire 7 nations of Utes, to push them off those 12 million acres of land waiting to be dug up, dammed up, and properly deforested so that fortunes could be made in the process. Oray was a dying man in 1880 when the Indian Bureau brought him to Washington to defend the future of his people. Ill with nephritis, he bowed to the wishes of Big Eyes, Shirts, and other officials who decided the Utes must go to a new reservation in Utah, on land the Mormons did not want. Oray died before the army herded his people together in August 1881 for the 350-mile march out of Colorado into Utah. Except for a small strip of territory along the southwest corner, where a small band of southern Utes was allowed to live, Colorado was swept clean of Indians. Cheyenne and Arapaho, Kiowa and Comanche, Jicarilla and Ute. They had all known its mountains and plains, but now no trace of them remained but their names on the white man's land. Chapter 17. The Last of the Apache Chiefs. 1880, June 1st, population of United States is 50,155,783. 1881, March 4th, James A. Garfield inaugurated as president. March 13th, in Russia, nihilists assassinate Tsar Alexander. July 2nd, Garfield, shot by assassin, dies September 19th. Chester A. Arthur becomes president. 1882, April 3rd, Jesse James, shot and killed at St. Joseph, Missouri. September 4th, Edison switches on first commercial electric lights in New York Central Station. Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn published. 1883, March 24th, first telephone connection between New York and Chicago. November 3rd, U.S. Supreme Court decides that an American Indian is by birth an alien and a dependent. Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island published. 1884, January, Russia abolishes poll tax, last relic of serfdom. March 13th, in the Sudan, siege of Khartoum begins. 1885, January 26th, Khartoum falls to the Mahdi. Governor General Charles George Gordon killed. March 4th, Grover Cleveland becomes first Democratic president since Civil War. 1886, May 1st, general strikes spread across United States in demand for 8-hour day. May 4th, anarchists bomb police in Haymarket Square, Chicago, killing 7, wounding 60. October 28th, Statue of Liberty erected on Bedloe's Island. December 8th, American Federation of Labor founded. I was living peacefully with my family, having plenty to eat, sleeping well, taking care of my people, and perfectly contented. I don't know where those bad stories first came from. There we were doing well, and my people well. I was behaving well. I hadn't killed a horse or man, American or Indian. I don't know what was the matter with the people in charge of us, They knew this to be so, and yet they said I was a bad man, and the worst man there. But what had I done? I was living peacefully there with my family under the shade of the trees, doing just what General Crook had told me I must do, and trying to follow his advice. I want to know now who it was ordered me to be arrested. I was praying to the light and to the darkness, to God and to the sun, to let me live quietly there with my family. I don't know what the reason was that people should speak badly of me. Very often there are stories put in the newspapers that I am to be hanged. I don't want that any more. When a man tries to do right, such stories ought not to be put in the newspapers. There are very few of my men left now. They have done some bad things, but I want them all rubbed out now, and let us never speak of them again. There are very few of us left. Goyancla, Geronimo. After the death of Cochise in 1874, his oldest son, Tasa, became chief of the Chiricahuas, and Taglito, Tom Jeffords, continued as agent on the Apache Pass Reservation. Unlike his father, Tasa was not able to secure the steadfast allegiance of all the Chiricahuas. Within a few months, these Apaches were split into factions, and in spite of earnest efforts by both Tasa and Jeffords, the raiding which Cochise had strictly forbidden was resumed. Because of the Chiricahua Reservation's proximity to Mexico, it became a way station and sanctuary for Apache raiding parties moving in and out of Arizona and Mexico. Land-hungry settlers, miners, and politicians wasted no time in demanding removal of all Chiricahuas to some other location. By 1875, the United States government's Indian policy was turning toward concentration of tribes, either in Indian territory or on large regional reservations. White Mountain, with its 2.5 million acres in eastern Arizona, was larger than all the other Apache reservations in the Southwest combined. Its agency, San Carlos, was already the administration point for 7 Apache bands. And when Washington officials began receiving reports of trouble on the Chiricahua Reservation, they saw this as an excellent excuse to move the Chiricahuas to San Carlos. The agency, located at the junction of the San Carlos and Gila Rivers, was considered by Army officers as a most undesirable hardship post. "A gravelly flat," wrote one, "rose some 30 feet or so above the river bottoms and was dotted here and there by the drab adobe buildings of the agency. Scrawny, dejected lines of scattered cottonwoods, shrunken, almost leafless, marked the course of the streams. Rain was so infrequent that it took on the semblance of a phenomenon when it came at all. Almost continuously, dry, hot, dust and gravel-laden winds swept the plain, denuding it of every vestige of vegetation. In summer, a temperature of 110 degrees in the shade was cool weather. At all other times of the year, flies, gnats, unnameable bugs swarmed in the millions." The agent at this post in 1875 was John Clum, who a few months earlier had rescued Eskimensen and his Aravaipas from Camp Grant and helped them become virtually self-sufficient on irrigated land along the Gila River. In his stubborn way, Clum forced the military to withdraw from the vast White Mountain Reservation, and he replaced the troops with a company of Apaches to police their own agency, as well as establishing an Apache courts system to try offenders. Although his superiors were suspicious of Clum's unorthodox method of permitting Indians to make their own decisions, they could not quarrel with his success in keeping peace at San Carlos. On May 3, 1876, Agent Clum received a telegram from the Commissioner of Indian Affairs ordering him to proceed to the Chiricahua Reservation to take charge of the Indians there, suspend Agent Jeffords, and remove the Chiricahuas to San Carlos. Clum had no enthusiasm for this distasteful assignment. He doubted that the freedom-loving Chiricahuas would adjust to the regulated life on White Mountain Reservation. Insisting that the Army keep its cavalrymen at a distance, Clum took his Indian police to Apache Pass to inform the Chiricahuas of their forced removal. He was surprised to find Jeffords and Tasa cooperative. Tasa, like his father Cochise, wanted to keep peace. If the Chiricahuas must leave their homeland and go to White Mountain in order to keep the peace, they would do so. Only about half the Chiricahuas, however, marched overland to San Carlos. When the army moved into the abandoned reservation to round up the recalcitrants, most of them fled across the border into Mexico. Among their leaders was a 46-year-old Betancohe Apache who had allied himself as a youth with Mangus Colorado, and then afterward followed Cochise, and now considered himself a Chiricahua. He was Goyancla, better known to the white man as Geronimo. Although the Chiricahuas who went voluntarily to San Carlos did not have the same warmth of feeling for Agent Klum that some of the other Apache bands did, they caused him no trouble. Later in the summer of 1876, when Klum secured permission from the Indian Bureau to take 22 Apaches on a tour of the East, he invited Tassa to go along. Unfortunately, while the party was visiting Washington, Tassa died suddenly of pneumonia and was buried in the Congressional Cemetery. Upon Klum's return to San Carlos, he was confronted by Nechi, a younger brother of Tassa. "You took my brother away," Nechi said. "He was well and strong, but you come back without him, and you say he is dead. I do not know. I think maybe you not take good care of him. You let him be killed by evil spirits of Paleface. I have great pain in my heart." Klum attempted to reassure Nechi by asking Eskimensin to give an account of Tassa's death and burial, but the Chiricahuas remained suspicious. Without Tuglito Jeffords to advise them, they were not sure how far they could trust John Klum or any other white man. During the winter of 1876-77, their relatives from Mexico occasionally slipped into the reservation with news of events below the border. They heard that Geronimo and his band were raiding their old enemies, the Mexicans, and were accumulating large herds of cattle and horses. In the spring, Geronimo brought these stolen livestock up to New Mexico, sold them to white ranchers, and bought new guns, hats, boots, and much whiskey. These Chiricahuas settled down in a hideout near their Mimbrous cousins at the Ojo Caliente Agency, where Victorio was chief. In March 1877, John Klum received orders from Washington to take his Apache police to Ojo Caliente and transfer the Indians there to San Carlos. In addition, he was to arrest Geronimo and any other renegade Chiricahuas found in the vicinity. Geronimo told about it afterward. "Two companies of scouts were sent from San Carlos. They sent word for me and Victorio to come to town. The messengers did not say what they wanted with us, but as they seemed friendly, we thought they wanted a council and rode in to meet the officers. As soon as we arrived in town, soldiers met us, disarmed us, and took us both to headquarters where we were tried by court-martial. They asked us only a few questions, and then Victorio was released and I was sentenced to the guardhouse. Scouts conducted me to the guardhouse and put me in chains. When I asked them why they did this, they said it was because I had left Apache Pass. I do not think that I ever belonged to those soldiers at Apache Pass, or that I should have asked them where I might go. I was kept a prisoner for 4 months, during which time I was transferred to San Carlos. Then I think I had another trial, although I was not present. In fact, I do not know that I had another trial, but I was told that I had, and at any rate I was released." Although Victorio was not put under arrest, he and most of the Warm Springs Apaches were transferred to San Carlos in the spring of 1877. Klum made an effort to win Victorio's confidence by assigning him more authority than the chief had ever had at Ojo Caliente. For a few weeks it seemed as if peaceable Apache communities might be developed on the White Mountain Reservation, but then suddenly the army moved a company of soldiers to the Gila River, Fort Thomas. The army announced this as a precautionary move because of the concentration at San Carlos of nearly all of the most refractory Indians in the territory. Klum was furious. He telegraphed the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, requesting authority to equip an additional company of Apache police to replace the soldiers, and asking that the military be removed. In Washington, newspapers learned of Klum's bold demand and published it. The story aroused the ire of the War Department. In Arizona and New Mexico, civilian army contractors, fearing a wholesale departure of soldiers and a loss of lucrative business, condemned the brass and impudence of the 26-year-old upstart who thought he could do alone what several thousand soldiers had been unable to do since the Apache Wars began. The army stayed at San Carlos, and John Klum resigned. Although simpatico, Klum had never learned to think as an Apache, to make himself into an Apache, as Tom Jeffords had done. He could not understand the chiefs who resisted to the bitter end. He could not see them as heroic figures who preferred death to the loss of their heritage. In John Klum's eyes, Geronimo, Victorio, Nane, Loco, Nechi, and the other fighters were outlaws, thieves, murderers, and drunkards, too reactionary to take the white man's road. And so John Klum left the Apaches at San Carlos. He went to Tombstone, Arizona, and founded a crusading newspaper, The Epitaph. Before summer's end of 1877, conditions at San Carlos became chaotic. Although the number of Indians had increased by several hundred, additional supplies were slow in arriving. To make matters worse, instead of distributing rations at various camps, the new agent required that all the bands come to the main agency building. Some of the Apaches had to walk 20 miles, and if old people and children were unable to come, they received no rations. Miners also encroached upon the northeastern portion of the reservation and refused to leave. The self-policing system established by Clum began to break down. On the night of September 2nd, Victorio led his Warm Springs band off the reservation and started back to Ojo Caliente. Apache police went in pursuit, recaptured most of the horses and mules that the Warm Springs Indians had taken from the White Mountain corrals, but let the people go. After engaging in several fights with ranchers and soldiers along the way, Victorio reached Ojo Caliente. For a year, the army let him and his people stay there under guard of soldiers from Fort Wingate, and then, late in 1878, orders came to take them back to San Carlos. Victorio begged the army officers to let his people live in the country where they had been born, but when he realized that this was not to be, he shouted, "You can take our women and children in your wagons, but my men will not go." Victorio and about 80 of his warriors fled into the Mimbres Mountains to spend a hard winter away from their families. In February 1878, Victorio and a few men came into the post at Ojo Caliente and offered to surrender if the army would return their families from San Carlos. For weeks, the army delayed its decision, then finally announced that it would compromise. The Warm Springs Apaches could make their homes in New Mexico, but they would have to live with the Mescaleros at Tularosa. Victorio agreed, and for the third time in 2 years, he and his people had to begin life over again. In the summer of 1879, an old charge of horse stealing and murder was brought up against Victorio, and lawmen entered the reservation to put him under arrest. Victorio escaped, and this time he resolved that never again would he put himself upon the mercy of white men by living on a reservation. He was convinced that he had been marked for death, and that all Apaches were doomed unless they fought back as they had been doing in Mexico since the coming of the Spaniards. Establishing a stronghold in Mexico, Victorio began recruiting a guerrilla army to make war forever against the United States. Before the end of 1879, he had a warrior band of 200 Mescaleros and Chiricahuas. To obtain horses and supplies, they raided Mexican ranches and then made daring thrusts into New Mexico and Texas, killing settlers where they could find them, ambushing, pursuing cavalry forces, and then dashing back across the border. As the constant fighting continued, Victorio's hatred deepened. He became a ruthless killer, torturing and mutilating his victims. Some of his followers considered him a madman and left him. A price of $3,000 was placed on his head. At last, the United States and Mexican armies decided to cooperate in a concentrated effort to track him down. On October 14, 1880, Mexican soldiers trapped Victorio's band in the Tres Castillos Hills between Chihuahua and El Paso. They slaughtered 78 Apaches, including Victorio, and captured 68 women and children. About 30 warriors escaped. Among those who escaped was a Mimbres warrior who had already passed his 70th birthday. His name was Nané. He had been fighting Spanish-speaking white men and English-speaking white men as long as he could remember. In Nané's mind, there was no doubt that the resistance must continue. He would recruit another guerrilla army, and the best source for warriors was the reservations, where hundreds of young men were penned up with nothing to do. In the summer of 1881, this scarred and wrinkled little Apache crossed the Rio Grande with his handful of followers. In less than a month, they fought 8 battles, captured 200 horses, and escaped back into Mexico with 1,000 cavalrymen on their heels. Nané's raids were nowhere near White Mountain, but the Apaches there heard of his daring exploits, and the army reacted by dispatching hundreds of troops to guard the reservation. In September, the Chiricahuas at San Carlos were alarmed by a cavalry demonstration near their camp. Rumors were flying everywhere. It was said that the army was preparing to arrest all leaders who had ever been hostile. One night late in the month, Geronimo, Hu, Nechi, and about 70 Chiricahuas slipped out of White Mountain and raced southward for their old Sierra Madre stronghold in Mexico. 6 months later, April 1882, well-armed and equipped, the Chiricahuas returned to White Mountain. They were determined to free all their people and any other Apaches who wanted to return to Mexico with them. It was an audacious enterprise. They galloped into Chief Loco's camp and persuaded most of the remaining Chiricahuas and Warm Springs Apaches to leave for Mexico. In swift pursuit came 6 companies of cavalry commanded by Colonel George A. Forsyth. He had survived the battle when Roman Nose was killed. At Horseshoe Canyon, Forsyth caught up with the fleeing Apaches, but in a brilliant rearguard action the Indians held off the troopers long enough for the main body to cross into Mexico. Here, disaster struck from an unexpected source. A Mexican infantry regiment stumbled upon the Apache column, slaughtering most of the women and children who were riding in front. Among the chiefs and warriors who escaped were Loco, Nechi, Chato, and Geronimo. Embittered, their ranks depleted, they soon joined forces with old Nané and his guerrillas. For all of them, it was now a war of survival. Each recent outbreak at White Mountain had brought an increase in the number of soldiers. They swarmed everywhere, at Fort Thomas, Fort Apache, Fort Bowie. And each increase brought more unrest among the Apaches on the reservation, more flights to Mexico, with the inevitable raiding against ranchers along the escape routes. To bring order out of chaos, the army again called on General George Crook, quite a different man from the one who had left Arizona 10 years earlier to go north to fight the Sioux and Cheyennes. He had learned from them, and from the Poncas during the trial of Standing Bear, that Indians were human beings, a viewpoint that most of his fellow officers had not yet accepted. On September 4, 1882, Crook assumed command of the Department of Arizona at Whipple Barracks, and then hurried on to the White Mountain Reservation. He held councils with the Apaches at San Carlos and Fort Apache. He searched out individual Indians and talked privately with them. I discovered immediately that a general feeling of distrust of our people existed among all the bands of the Apaches, he reported. It was with much difficulty that I got them to talk, but after breaking down their suspicions, they conversed freely with me. They told me that they had lost confidence in everybody and did not know whom or what to believe, that they were constantly told by irresponsible parties that they were to be disarmed, that they were to be attacked by troops on the reservation and removed from their country, and that they were fast arriving at the conclusion that it would be more manly to die fighting than to be thus destroyed. Crook was convinced that the reservation Apaches had not only the best reasons for complaining, but had displayed remarkable forbearance in remaining at peace. Early in his investigations, he discovered that the Indians had been plundered of their rations and of the goods purchased by the government for their subsistence and support by rascally agents and other unscrupulous white men. He found plenty of evidence that white men were trying to arouse the Apaches to violent action so that they could be driven from the reservation, leaving it open for land grabbing. Crook ordered immediate removal of all white squatters and miners from the reservation, and then demanded complete cooperation from the Indian Bureau in introducing reforms. Instead of being forced to live near San Carlos or Fort Apache, the different bands were given the right to choose any part of the reservation to build their homes and ranches. Pay contracts would be given to Apaches instead of to white suppliers. The army would buy all the excess corn and vegetables the Indians could raise, paying for it in cash. They would be expected to govern themselves, to reorganize their police and hold their own courts, as they had done under John Clum. Crook promised that they would see no soldiers on their reservation, unless they found it impossible to control themselves. At first the Apaches were skeptical. They remembered Crook's harsh ways in the old days when he was the Gray Wolf hunting down Cochise and the Chiricahuas. But they soon discovered that he meant what he said. Rations became more plentiful, the agents and traders no longer cheated them, there were no soldiers to bully them, and the Gray Wolf encouraged them to build up their herds and seek out better places to grow corn and beans. They were free again, so long as they remained within the reservation. But they could not forget their relatives who were truly free in Mexico, and there were always a few young men slipping southward, a few returning with exciting news of adventures and good times. Crook also gave much thought to the Chiricahuas and Warm Springs Apaches in Mexico. He knew it was only a matter of time before they would raid once again across the border, and he knew he must be ready for them. The United States government had recently signed an agreement with the Mexican government, permitting soldiers of each country to cross the border in pursuit of hostile Apaches. He was preparing to take advantage of this agreement, hoping that by doing so he could keep the Arizona and New Mexico civilians from forcing him to start a war. It is too often the case, Crook said, that border newspapers disseminate all sorts of exaggerations and falsehoods about the Indians, which are copied in papers of high character and wide circulation in other parts of the country, while the Indian side of the case is rarely ever heard. In this way, the people at large get false ideas with reference to the matter. Then when the outbreak does come, public attention is